This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. Protecting the country's borders, land, air, and sea from the illegal entry of people, weapons, drugs, and contraband is vital to homeland security as well as economic prosperity. One of today's greatest challenges is protecting the country against terrorists and instruments of terror, while at the same time fostering the country's economic security through lawful trade and travel. The U.S. Customs and Border Protection Agency, CBP, one of the Department of Homeland Security's largest and most complex components, operates at the nexus of national security and American economic security. What are CBP's key strategic priorities? How is CBP pursuing innovative security strategies? And what is CBP doing to be more efficient and effective in meeting its mission? We'll explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Kevin McAleenan, Acting Assistant Commissioner, Office of Field Operations, within the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Kevin, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thanks, Michael. Good to be here.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is Andy Maynor. Andy, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, Kevin, could you provide us with some context around the mission and history of the U.S. Customs and Border Protection? When was it started, and how has its mission evolved to date?
U.S. Customs and Border Protection, or CBP as we call it, was created as a unified border security agency of the United States as part of the U.S. government overall response to 9/11. It was really born officially in the Homeland Security Act of 2002, and it became operational on March 1st of 2003 with the stand-up of the Department of Homeland Security. It's the largest of the seven main operating components of the Department of Homeland Security, along with the U.S. Coast Guard, Secret Service, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or Homeland Security Investigations. And the central idea was that we could address our systemic weaknesses that 9/11 attacks had laid bare in a more effective manner if we integrated disparate components that were focused on border security in multiple departments of government into one agency under one Department of Homeland Security umbrella. In terms of how the Office of Field Operations is structured and its role in CBP, we're the key component that has responsibility of overseeing the ports of entry of the United States, where legal trade and travel it comes into the country. And the field operations is often called a merger within a merger within a merger. CBP already represented the largest merger of people and functions in DHS and really in the government since the Department of Defense was combined. And OFO is where the three inspectional components responsible at the ports of entry of the United States came together. The U.S. Customs Inspectors from the former Customs Service, the U.S. Immigration Inspectors from the Immigration and Naturalization Service, and the Border Inspectors from the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service. That's where we all became one unified border force, if you will. And our mission at the ports of entry, CBP is charged with securing and facilitating the flow of travelers and goods into the United States. This is 350 million people a year, $2.25 trillion worth of trade. And we have the unique authority and responsibility of determining whether people and goods are admissible, whether they're physically allowed in the country, whether they're safe, compliant, properly documented. And that's a tremendous and broad responsibility. And within that responsibility, we have several core mission sets. Our priority mission, as we were conceived, remains preventing terrorists and terrorist weapons from entering the country. But we also maintain significant missions in preventing contraband from the United States, preventing inadmissible persons, agriculture, pests, and animal diseases, products that are unsafe or violate intellectual property laws or other trade laws, and not to mention our revenue collection role. So it's a pretty dynamic and broad mission set and one that is never a dull moment.
Well, with such a critical mission, how many folks actually make it happen? And what's the size of your budget?
We're the largest component within CBP, and CBP is the largest component within the Department of Homeland Security. So overall, CBP is about 60,000 strong with over 40,000 uniformed law enforcement personnel. Not well known, but we're actually the largest law enforcement agency in the world. And so for field operations, the component at the ports of entry that I oversee, we have over 28,000 employees, a budget over $3.5 billion, and we work at 400 locations, 330 ports of entry in the United States, and about 70 locations in 40 countries globally. So it's a very, very broad footprint that we exercise.
And in your role, Kevin, running that Office of Field Operations, which you called OFO, what do you specifically, what's your daily tempo, and how do you execute your personal missions?
The Acting Assistant Commissioner of Field Operations is responsible for several kind of key roles. I have an operational oversight role that's not like a DOD model where there's an organized train and equip role for the service commander. It's an actual operational line and chain of command over what goes on in the field. I also have a key programmatic role, driving and developing our national programs, our risk assessment efforts, our trusted trader and trusted traveler programs, and our international operations. And then the third is really trying to support the commissioner and the deputy commissioner with our enterprise-wide decision-making and our strategy for the overall border management. So those are the things I'm engaged in day-to-day.
Kevin, with such an expansive portfolio and a critical mission, I'd like to delve into some of your top management challenges. Could you give us a sense of what they are and how you've sought to address them?
Sure. I mean, I think there's a number of key operational challenges that we're addressing very aggressively. The changing nature of global terrorism, for instance, or threats from transnational criminal organizations. But at the organizational management level, I think like many federal managers who come on this program, I think my central challenge is how do we keep pace with our growing and expanding mission in an era of reduced resources? Both our security and our facilitation responsibilities are too critical to the country for us to fail. And so the types of questions that my management team and I are constantly asking ourselves is how do we innovate and transform to make sure that our business processes are as efficient and as effective as possible and really create a culture where we're improving daily and relentlessly? How do we integrate and apply technology to increase the mobility and effectiveness of our frontline workforce? And how do we motivate and engage our personnel to maximize their job satisfaction and productivity and really try to make CBP field operations a law enforcement employer of choice in the federal government? You know, we're seeing record levels of trade and travel in all our environments, land, air, and sea. Since the bottom of the recession in 2009, for instance, we've seen 4% growth year over year in the air environment, to new records of travelers coming into the U.S., which is tremendous benefit economically. But at the same time, we've seen a leveling off of our resource and staffing levels, and our people and our equipment are becoming more expensive at the same time. So we're trying to tackle these challenges in a number of ways, capitalizing on technology, but also looking at our business processes and looking at every aspect we could do more efficiently. If I could give an example of how we're attacking this, the port of San Ysidro, the largest port of entry in the world, where we have 35,000 vehicles, 25,000 people crossing each day, is currently undergoing the largest construction project at a port of entry in history. The total project will change the way the port operates from 24 lanes to over 60. It'll create new pedestrian facilities, new secondary facilities, but we can't kind of shut down and move operations while that construction is happening. So we looked at this and realized we're going to have a significant challenge in keeping that critical trade between San Diego and Tijuana and really going into deep into the United States going during this construction. And we looked at how we could move people and things efficiently during this period. And we took a look at the toll booth model. For those who have used their Easy Pass in the federal National Capital Region here, you see that there are lanes where people have their Easy Pass, and they started out maybe one or two lanes at each toll booth as people were getting used to it. And you still have most customers paying cash and taking longer in those lines. Well, gradually they increased the number of E-ZPass lanes to really incentivize and force more of the traffic to go ahead and take the step of ordering your E-ZPass so you could get through the process more quickly. Well, we took a similar approach. We have a trusted traveler program that we operate on our southern land border called Sentry. And what we did is we started out with a few Sentry lanes, and we made a policy statement that we were not going to let the wait times in our Sentry lanes go over 15 minutes. And we're going to keep opening Sentry lanes to keep that wait time that low. Well, that drove participation from under 20% to over 37% of the traffic into the Sentry program. That allows us to clear those cars about two-thirds faster than a general lane and really expedite that traffic. At the same time, we had installed technology that allows us to use RFID, radio frequency identification device technology, to read people's documents as they approach our primary booth. So once they get to primary, we already know who they are, we know if there's a risk, and we're able to process them much more effectively. That's about 35% faster than a general lane. So we announced that we're going to keep the ready lanes at about half the weight of the general lanes. And that drove a lot more people to go get RFID-enabled documents. They didn't have to be a trusted partner. They didn't have to have a perfect background, but they could use an RFID document. So today we have almost 70% of our traffic at San Ysidro is using either a trusted lane or a ready lane. And that's allowed us to continue to operate during this massive construction project, allowed us to give consistency for those frequent border crossers and to make a real difference in how people and vehicles are moving across the border in Southern California. So that's kind of a microcosm of how we're trying to really use technology and look critically at our processes so that we can manage this increasing mission set in a period of really austere resources.
Kevin, I imagine with the broad mission that your office has that you embark on your strategic initiatives, but imagine that your daily inbox gets filled with new kind of fast-moving crises or opportunities. Give us a sense of your daily tempo and what are some of the things that hit you when you arrive at work in the morning?
Well, as I mentioned, with 350 million people hundreds of millions of cargo shipments a year coming across the border, there's never really a dull moment. And we have a saying, our deputy commissioner uses it, that you can't make this stuff up. You will always be confronted with something that we never imagined every week, really, in terms of what happens operationally at the border. The beginning of this week, we had an individual on an international flight come in with 15 birds. That were sedated in little wire mesh cages sewn into the lining of his jeans. And, who would think that someone would bring in birds in that manner? But we had an alert officer and a great ag specialist detect it, interdict those birds, which could carry bird diseases or other concerns that we want to prevent from entering the country. So we have that kind of surprise every day. But I think CBP prides itself on our crisis response capabilities and our abilities to look at adapting and evolving threats and respond to them with new programmatic efforts, with new technologies. We also are able to use our existing frameworks in new ways. I think the Japan nuclear disaster of a year and a half ago is a good example of that. When the Fukushima Daiichi plant melted down and had a significant radiation release, there was a lot of concern about products coming from Japan, one of our most critical trading partners, and whether they would be contaminated with radiation or even just the containers themselves or the passengers even. And what we have at CBP is we had a radiation detection apparatus in place that's designed to detect potential radiological materials that aren't compliant with laws or even a nuclear threat. And we were able to use that to give confidence to our federal partners, Department of Transportation, Environmental Protection Agency, that we could detect very low levels of contamination and work with them to resolve any concerns to keep that critical trade flowing into the U.S. And I think that's a good example of how we can respond to an emerging issue by using the systems and approaches we have in place in unique ways.
So, Kevin, given your experience, what makes an effective leader? What are some of the characteristics of an effective leader?
I think I mentioned some of the leaders that have influenced me. I think former Commissioner Bonner probably captures the strategic vision and the will and the skill and force of will to implement it that I try to emulate day to day. When I started working with him back in October of 2001, and he was looking at the threats we're facing and how do we strategically address them in a globally networked world, and he is proposing an idea called what became the Container Security Initiative, and this was to place customs officers in foreign seaports to work with host nation customs authorities, risk assess cargo that was going to be destined for the United States, but try to address that risk in concert with those authorities before it was ever laden on a vessel. A very big idea. And he called me into his office later in the evening, as he often did, to sort of talk through the concept. And I remember on the first hearing, I thought it was impossible. I thought that the sovereignty issues, the costs, the demands for reciprocity that we were likely to face, because not all of the ports are located in places where we have good day-to-day law enforcement collaboration. So it seemed like a very difficult concept to implement. And I remember him sort of furrowing his brow and let me say my piece and offer what I thought were the obstacles to this vision. And he just looked at me and said, "We're going to do it." And within a year, we had agreements with the 20 largest seaports in the world, and we're now in 58 seaports in 32 countries. And it's a core element of how the U.S. government maintains supply chain security in concert with our partners. So that ability to recognize that the perceived limits of an organization and the perceived boundaries that exist are really things that can be overcome with a strategic vision and the focus and drive to prioritize and implement it is really one of the leadership lessons I've tried to carry forward and try to emulate in what I do today.
What are CBP's strategic priorities? We will ask Kevin McAleenan, Acting Assistant Commissioner, Office of Field Operations with U.S. Customs and Border Protection, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is NIH doing to advance basic and biomedical research? What is being done to ensure the safety and soundness of the country's credit union system? How can government better manage risk, reduce waste, and use resources more wisely? What are the benefits of e-diplomacy? How are agencies adopting innovative new technologies and open government? And what are some of the key issues for governing in the next 4 years? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Kevin McAleenan, Acting Assistant Commissioner, Office of Field Operations with the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Andy Maynor. Well, Kevin, you've mentioned strategic vision and need for that. I'd like to delve into the strategic vision of field operations. And in particular, what are your key strategic priorities and how do you pursue them to meet your multidimensional mission?
Well, building on the foundation offered by Tom Winkowski, the vision I have is fairly significant for OFO. We want to be, as part of CBP, the premier law enforcement agency in the world, not just world-class, which I think we've attained already, but really the premier agency. And to me, that means the highest possible degree of mission effectiveness, becoming really the best at what we do, to be an innovative and dynamic organization that's constantly transforming, adopting new technologies and processes, being relentlessly self-critical in everything that we do. It's becoming the employer of choice in the federal law enforcement community with a recognized culture of leadership and excellence and employee engagement. And also, given our role in facilitating trade and travel, being transparent and collaborative, responsive to the American public, and working closely with our stakeholders, and of course, maintaining the highest standards of integrity. We have the broadest authorities, another key building block of any federal law enforcement agency. We have warrantless ability to search. We can stop, detain, and question individuals, and we have a responsibility to exercise that appropriately. And we have world-class capabilities with the amount of data we collect, our ability to analyze that data with automated systems in effective manners, our targeting capabilities, our abilities to inspect goods without slowing them down very much. These are non-intrusive inspection technologies, radiation portal monitors, or gamma imaging devices. We have a lot of capabilities there. On the partnership side, we're well positioned, both with our interagency community, starting with our investigators at Homeland Security Investigations. We can't carry out our mission effectively on the interdiction side without that collaboration with the investigators to dismantle the organizations and proceed to prosecution. And then the global efforts, those are critical partnerships for us, with not only with our North American partners, but internationally, and of course the private sectors. So in our strategic priorities, what are we – we've got a good foundation. So what are we doing to address the pieces we still need to work on? I think we need to constantly improve our capabilities. Again, if the goal is to be the absolute best at what we do, we really need to invest in our strengths. Our unique position at the borders provides us access to so much information. We need to marshal that information effectively. We need to get the right answer to our frontline personnel about whether this person or good might present a risk to the United States across our broad mission set. And we need to continue to transform and innovate. We have a whole series of what we call our business transformation initiatives that are really looking critically at all of our core processes. Time-honored traditions of how we process air passengers with written customs declarations, and you go to primary and then you go to secondary, and each of these missions are taken in sequence. We want to look at that in entirely new ways, try to use technology to accomplish as much of the administrative portions of those missions before that person arrives at the border. So that encounter can be a law enforcement-focused, very, very facilitative and quick and expedited process. And so these are the kind of things we're working on to develop our organization in the capability side. And then lastly, it's the investment in our people. We are recruiting a tremendous caliber of individual across all of our disciplines, our CBP officers, our agriculture specialists, our trade specialists, and our mission support personnel. We've gotten to the point where our basic training academy is absolutely world-class and is really producing officers and agriculture specialists that are ready to do the job on day one. And it's a complex and broad one, as we talked about. So now we need to work on engaging them in their leadership development at multiple stages in their career, really defining career roadmaps for them so they know how to manage the various opportunities they have in their career. So it's those capabilities, the culture, and investing in our people that I think will take us to that next level as an organization and position us for the challenges of the future.
Well, actually, I'd like to talk a little bit more and about specific initiatives that you're pursuing, and I'd like to delve into one, and that is the Southwest Border Initiative, which I believe began in March of 2009. And I want to get a sense of what is it, and what have you been able to accomplish in this effort, and more particularly, what are some of the challenges that you encounter while massing and protecting the Southwest border?
Sure. I think the story on the Southwest border is a very good one. It's been an exciting time with some tremendous accomplishments since 2009 with the Southwest Border Initiative and even going back since the creation of U.S. Customs and Border Protection. We've deployed historic levels of personnel, technology, and infrastructure both at and between the ports of entry on the Southwest border. And I think we're better positioned than ever to address the threats we face there. My colleagues in the Border Patrol, for instance, are better staffed than any time in their 88-year history. They're now at a resource level that's much more commensurate with the massive challenge of securing our border between ports of entry. And the results are there. Their apprehensions, a key indicator of illegal immigration, have decreased about 50% in the last 3 years and are roughly 22% of what they were at their peak. And they've been much more effective at interdicting individuals crossing the border at the same time. And at the ports of entry, we've also made significant investments. We've implemented the Western Hemisphere Traveler Initiative, which is those technologies that I was talking about relating to San Ysidro that enable us to move traffic more effectively, but also much more securely. It's a little known fact that at the time of 9/11, basically only about 5% of land border crossings were the people's documents actually checked and queried through a system. We're at over 98% today through the implementation of these technologies. We have license plate readers, next generation license plate readers that are capturing all the vehicles crossing. And that creates an environment that's much more secure, has led to thousands of seizures and enforcement actions, and is really finding those potential bad actors at the border while still moving trade and travel effectively. I think in terms of the challenges we still continue to face, one is, you know, we really want to support the government of Mexico's law enforcement efforts against the transnational criminal organizations, those powerful drug cartels that are operating in several areas of Mexico. And we'd like to help them choke off the supply of money and guns going southbound. And that's been a commitment made by this department. The challenge we face is that in terms of our staffing resources, our infrastructure, and our technology, it's positioned to focus on the inbound traffic. So the outbound traffic, you go to San Diego, as I mentioned earlier, and it's basically Interstate 5 driving right into Mexico. There's no port there. There are no booths. There's no canopy. There's not even anything that slows down the vehicles. That kind of situation is present at many of our major crossings and really presents a challenge as we try to check that traffic going outbound and to try to interdict some of the potential guns and money going south. And we've had tremendous successes. We increased our outbound currency seizures dramatically through 2011. We increased our weapon seizures, but that's going to be a continued effort to how do we balance and risk manage with the infrastructure, with the personnel, our outbound mission. Another area we're faced with, this is kind of in the organizational management side as well as operationally, is how do we integrate the components of CBP in the most effective way. We call it our mission integration agenda. I mean, this is not only to be more effective in terms of our operations, but it's a budget reality. And so we're testing different models of ensuring that we work as closely as possible with our counterparts in the Border Patrol, with our colleagues in Air and Marine in securing that southwest border. So we're not three independent components that sort of share a parent in D.C., but that we actually day-to-day are integrated completely in our operations. And so we're starting to apply our joint resources in a really integrated fashion, this both on the outbound side, but many of our outbound efforts have been enabled by the fact that we have Border Patrol working with us at the ports of entry going southbound. We also have been sharing our canine assets, which are tremendously effective tools in identifying both narcotics as well as weapons and currency. The Border Patrol has a significant complement of canines, and we're now using them sometimes at ports of entry, sometimes at checkpoints in a collaborative manner. And we've also shared our lessons learned from the ports of entry with the Border Patrol to apply at checkpoints. How do you use non-intrusive inspection technology effectively? How do you use data on the cargo that's crossing the border so they can find potential risks and seizures at those interior checkpoints that are a critical line of defense in protecting the southwest border? So those are the challenges we're moving into. And of course, at the same time, we have trade up 6% last year and continuing to grow on the southwest border. This is outstanding, rebounding from the recession, but also means we have many more trucks and rail cars that we need to clear efficiently. And so that goes back to ensuring we're as efficient and effective as possible in all of our processes. So that's what we'll be continuing to work on.
As a follow-up to that, Kevin, most Americans read a lot about the southern border, but you've also got a pretty expansive border on the northern border and in the coastal regions of the United States. How do you deal with that vastness and move that forward each year?
Well, all of our border environments present different risks and challenges, and absolutely we have the longest shared land border in the world is between the United States and Canada. We see different threats. The terrorism threat is most severe in the air environment, for instance, narcotic smuggling, obviously, on the southwest border. And then we have some of our most important trade facilitation challenges in the seaports and on the northern border. So we have to apply the right mix of programs, techniques, and technology in each of those environments. The first is called Beyond the Border, looking with Canada at how do we manage our shared land border and shared air border in the most efficient way possible to address threats early in the process, to facilitate trade, to ensure that our cross-border law enforcement efforts are as integrated as possible. These are organizations that are not just in Canada or just in the U.S. They're transnational. And that we have a shared approach to investing in infrastructure across our land border. And we're looking at all sorts of potential solutions, including pre-inspection, using that limited infrastructure on the land border in new and innovative ways to maybe clear cargo in advance before it actually arrives at that more restricted port of entry, developing and harmonizing our trusted trader and trusted traveler concepts.
Kevin, you mentioned the trade community, and Customs has a unique relationship with them. How do you deal with the mass of information, and how do you establish risk management principles when dealing with so many commercial entities that are approaching you in so many different modes? How do you work through that?
The process is what we call it risk segmentation or risk management, and that has many different components to it. First, it's we try to learn as much as possible, both about the individual transaction, the individual shipment coming into the country or leaving the country, as well as the supply chain participants that are involved with that shipment. And we try to marshal that information with advanced analytics and automated targeting systems to sort through that vast amount of data and come up with those limited numbers, the very, very small number of non-compliant or potentially risky shipments to focus that for our officers in the field to take in some inspectional action and screen that physically and more aggressively. So the core components of that are our data collection efforts. We work with the trade community to receive information on all sea, air, and land cargo shipments coming into the U.S. We try to get that information before it arrives at the border in the sea and air environment, even before it's laden on a vessel or loaded into an aircraft destined for the U.S. So if there's a security risk, we can work with them to take action and mitigate that risk before it even departs for the United States. The second piece of that is working through all of that data with our targeting system, with our partners and the investigative agencies to decide what we want to focus on. And then the third piece is taking effective action to inspect it thoroughly and effectively at the earliest possible point in the process. The other sort of half of the process is the trade partnerships. I mentioned the Customs Trade Partnership Against Terrorism, the 10,500 members. Those members are actually responsible for well over 50% of the value of trade coming to the United States. So when we have worked with them to validate their supply chains from the very start, the manufacturer in the foreign country, through their transshipment points on the carriers headed to the U.S., and then destined to their import location in the United States. We know that they work with trusted partners. We know that they have taken security measures that we've recommended, and we've validated those by actually visiting their facilities, by meeting with their management and ensuring that they have a mindset to secure the global supply chain. And the result of that is we're able to treat those shipments as less risky. They're seven times less likely to have a secondary examination, and so their trade moves much more quickly. We're able to focus our finite resources on higher risk shipments and really have a better understanding about the traffic and the global supply chain. So it's really a combination of data, analytics, effective inspections, and partnerships that's helping us get the job done.
Kevin, you mentioned the Container Security Initiative, CSI. Would you tell us how you're leveraging emerging technologies to make the program more efficient and cost-effective?
Well, the key area that we're investing in on the technology side in support of the Container Security Initiative is those advanced analytics. It's taking our targeting efforts to the next level, trying to capitalize on the power of machine learning, augmenting what we already do very well, which is take intelligence and apply it through business rules to help sort travel transactions and trade transactions, and then adding this new layer, which is the power of a computer process to look at many more factors simultaneously. Instead of having an individual for those of us that are old enough to have done Boolean queries in the early search engines, where you have to combine a series of terms with if-then relationships, to go beyond that and have a machine look at 88, 150, 200 variables simultaneously in a much more comprehensive way that can bring risks and patterns to the forefront that we wouldn't have seen as individual targeters or analysts. So I think that's the key investment, is really helping us identify potential risk more efficiently. The other side of that is again, staying in the analytics sphere for a moment, is what we call entity resolution or entity disambiguation. That's we have a lot of information where we have known risks. We have either individuals or companies that are watchlisted because they might present a concern. They've been involved in illegal activity, potential terrorist activity. And unfortunately, lots of people and things have people and entities have similar names. How do we make sure we're not impacting, we're only finding the known threats and the right threats? That process of having our algorithms be continuously refined so that we don't miss anybody, but we don't have a lot of false positives that we have to sort through is a critical investment for us on the technology side. But CSI, I mentioned Commissioner Bonner's vision in 2002. That will continue to be a core of our global supply chain security efforts. We've built partnerships with customs administrations and law enforcement partners in 32 countries. We're addressing potential security risks on 50,000 containers a year before they're ever laden and sent to the United States. Inspecting them thoroughly, saving time and money upon arrival, and ensuring there was no threat in the process. And we've been able to expand and work with our partners on other mission sets, narcotics, for instance, trade violations. And that will continue to be sort of a cornerstone program for our supply chain security efforts, even as we look at ways of leveraging these partnerships so there's less of a need to have large physical presence in foreign countries.
How is CBP pursuing innovative security strategies? We will ask Kevin McAleenan, Acting Assistant Commissioner, Office of Field Operations with U.S. Customs and Border Protection, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is NIH doing to advance basic and biomedical research? How can government better manage risk, reduce waste, and use resources more effectively? What are the benefits of e-diplomacy? How are agencies adopting innovative technologies in open government? And what are some of the key issues for governing in the next 4 years? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. This edition highlights the latest trends and best practices for improving government effectiveness by introducing you to government executives, public management practitioners, leading academics, and the differing ways they tackle many of the pressing public management issues facing us today. Hear from NIH Director Dr. Francis Collins, OMB's Danny Warfel, NCUA Chair Debbie Matz, VA's Dr. Peter Levin, and Rich Boley from the State Department. All of this and much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order or download your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Kevin McAleenan, Acting Assistant Commissioner, Office of Field Operations with the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Andy Maynor. Kevin, your office has many tools and technologies at its disposal to ensure safe and secure flow of trade and travel. To that end, would you tell us more about the role of the National Targeting Center and the automated targeting system and how they play in your strategy?
Absolutely. The National Targeting Center and the automated targeting system that really enables it is the foundation of that concept of risk segmentation or risk management that's absolutely critical to our effective operations, given the volume of trade and travel we interact with. So we need to have those accurate targeting approaches to focus finite resources on potentially higher risk passengers and cargo. We've got a couple different aspects of how we approach risk assessment from the National Targeting Center. I think the expectation of the American people, and certainly our expectation, is that we must accurately and effectively identify and interdict all potentially known watchlisted threats. So people that our intelligence community, our Department of Defense, our investigative partners have determined might present a risk, we want to make sure we identify their travel and that we take steps to mitigate any potential risk that it poses. The second side is a little bit harder. It's working to find the needles in the haystack that aren't known as threats, to scrutinize risk factors associated with shipments and with travel that might show that they have a greater risk to the United States, and we might need to either inspect them upon arrival, inspect them before they even leave the foreign port of origin, or prevent them from entering the U.S. at all. So in the last 3 years, we've taken an already critical tool for us to the next level and really pushed everything we're doing earlier in the process to increase our zone of security. Many of your listeners will remember Christmas Day 2009 when we had the attempted attack from Farouk Abdulmutallab on a flight into Detroit. And he was an individual who we were set up to put in secondary and interview and potentially deny entry to the United States to upon arrival. We knew he was coming. We were concerned about his potential admissibility. What we learned from that event is we needed to use that capability as early as possible in the process and to take those targeting efforts into the pre-departure environment. And we've done so in coordination with our interagency partners, with our investigative partners at FBI, at ICE, with the Department of State, in a way that's really changed the potential for inadmissible persons who may present a threat to the U.S. Or to the aircraft that they're coming onto the U.S. Before they even board those planes. So in 2009, working with the carriers and our international footprint of what we call our Immigration Advisory Program officers, we prevented boarding for about 450 people that were destined to the U.S. This fiscal year to date, we've already done it for over 4,000 potential travelers. So these are folks that were going to be deemed inadmissible upon arrival, many of whom may have presented some type of security threat, some of which are watchlisted, but others who had other concerns that we were going to address in the old days upon arrival, and preventing them from even boarding the aircraft. So that has tremendous security benefits. So another example was the Al-Qaeda in the Iran Peninsula attempted attack with two printer cartridge shipments originating from Yemen. In those cargo shipments in the air environment prior to that event, they wouldn't send information about what's on that plane until about 4 hours prior to arrival. Given the attempted attack, we noted that that plane might not have made it. So inspecting those shipments upon arrival was not going to help address that threat. So we sat down with the private sector in a process that our deputy commissioner has named co-creation, and really looked at what could we do together. What point in their supply chain did they have information about that shipment that we could use with our targeting systems to identify a risk and maybe take action before it was ever laden on an aircraft? And in a very rapid process for government and trade to work together, within 6 weeks, we were starting to receive data from the four major express consignment carriers, Federal Express, UPS, DHL, and TNT. And we were able to target those shipments for risk and then give that feedback to the carrier so they could inspect them and mitigate any risk prior to putting them on the aircraft. That's a pilot program that we now have 22 members participating.
Kevin, you've mentioned a lot about trusted traveler programs during our show today. Can you talk a little bit more about how you utilize those programs and how you use technology or your vision for using technology to make them more effective as we go forward? Obviously, you've mentioned passenger counts are up, the land border counts are up, bigger planes are now flying into our airports. How do you combine the membership in those with technology?
It's a great question, and the trusted traveler efforts are really a key component of our overall approach. We've got three major trusted traveler programs: Global Entry in the air environment, Sentry, which is the Southwest Border Land Border Program, and Nexus, which is the program with Canada that applies for both land border traffic and in the preclearance air environment. And you just think of a passenger traveling. They're coming off a 14-hour flight, landing at maybe one of the peak periods at the busy terminals at JFK. And instead of waiting for an hour or more, they can go through processing in just a few minutes because we've taken these steps to work with them up front and do a background check, conduct an interview, and basically do an advanced admissibility determination. You think about the Lamborger environment that you mentioned, Andy, and a daily commuter at San Ysidro, 15 minutes maximum wait time instead of a 90 minutes or more. So it has tremendous benefits, first to that individual, that expediting our trusted and most frequent travelers with 70% faster processing times in the air environment, sometimes even more in the land border environment. Secondly, enhancing security by allowing us to focus on potentially higher risk passengers, get as many folks into the trusted lanes, and we're able to focus our resources effectively on those travelers we know less about. And it also saves significant resources. The equivalent processing savings of dozens of officers annually in each of the environments we're operating in, and lowers costs in other ways too. The Global Entry members, for instance, use an automated kiosk to enter their customs declaration. We don't have to collect that paper form and scan it and store it and maintain it anymore. We can become paperless as we increase our trusted traveler participation. And so we are applying this technology, and the technology we have today is outstanding, and we're going to continue to improve it. But we're using touchscreen kiosks with passport readers, with biometric confirmation capability, and we're continuing to explore improving those user interfaces, using maybe other biometric options such as iris, which are even faster and require less instruction about how to place the fingerprints. So our next step is to try to continue to drive up the number of uses in every environment. We want as many people as possible in these trusted programs. So Global Entry and Nexus and Sentry are going to continue to be central aspects of our strategy. We're continuing to try to get the word out and increase that enrollment. We're up to about 60,000 applications a month, which is tremendous, and we want to continue to grow that exponentially.
Well, Kevin, I'd like to switch gears a bit and talk about infrastructure. And in particular, the existing border crossing infrastructure was built decades ago. And I'd like to understand a little bit more about what your agency is doing to expand and modernize these border crossings.
That is a challenge for us nationally, I think, in a significant way, and an important question. And really part of what's driving those partnerships I talked about, the Beyond the Border and the 21st Century Border. I think the first thing we're doing, going back to our overall strategic priorities, is looking at that transformation piece. How do we use that time and space prior to the individual, the vehicles, the cargo shipments arrival at that constricted port of entry, at that point where there is an infrastructure limitation, as effectively as possible? And that's advanced data, that's securing the supply chain as it approaches the border. That's those concepts we were talking about, like a pre-inspection pilot for clearing a certain commodity or certain type of traffic before it even arrives at the border, so that when it comes through the port of entry, it can speed through really without stopping. The second is really continuing to invest in our technology so that we can move people as quickly as possible. I think a good example of that is what we're calling our pedestrian reengineering efforts. This is now in place in Otay Mesa in the San Diego area and at Paso del Norte in El Paso. And that's just like the ready lane for vehicles. So people with radio frequency identification documents can approach a reader, have their document read very quickly as before they get to the primary booth, and so our officer, before they even step forward, knows who they are, knows if there's any risks or concerns with that individual, and can quickly move to questioning and facilitating that person's arrival. So that the technology application is going to be critical. Given the limitations in the Federal Buildings Fund budget, which is the fund where our major infrastructure projects come from, and it's been zeroed out the last several years in light of the budget realities we're all facing, I think we need to be innovative and look at the prospects for public-private partnerships, where there is a business case that a group of private sector entities and other investors and state and locals can come together with the federal government to jointly invest in new infrastructure or improving existing infrastructure, staffing it effectively, and having the right technology.
Kevin, you talked with a great sense of pride in the beginning about your workforce. How do you, with such a growing workforce with a diversity of missions that includes agriculture, immigration, et cetera, how do you train them? How do you think about training them? And kind of how do you create a culture of leadership and a mentoring culture that takes the agency forward?
That, as I mentioned, is one of our highest priorities. We have a set of initiatives we're calling our leadership engagement initiatives to try to really galvanize that workforce. First, we're looking at how do we train leaders. We're really, really happy with our basic academy and the skill sets it's producing, the esprit de corps and the commitment to mission that our folks are coming out with. We embarked on a multi-year effort to revolutionize that curriculum and learn lessons from the Border Patrol Academy, from some of the military academies, and apply those at the CBP Officer Basic Academy. And we're really pleased with the results. We're also trying to take structural steps to ensure that our managers have that engagement with their front line as part of their core responsibilities and that they identify with that role. It's not just managing people, getting them in booths and putting them in secondary environments and trying to find bad people and dangerous goods. It's about who those people are. What are their skill sets? What are their career aspirations? How do we reach out to them and make them feel good about the organization they're part of? And we're trying to kind of pair up mentors and also create a structure where we have supervisors that are responsible for a certain group of incoming officers in a much more direct way. That they need to touch base with them every pay period. How are they doing mission-wise? How are they doing training-wise? How are they doing personally? And try to really develop that sort of culture. And lastly, just continuing to convey the importance of everything they do every day and asking the American people to understand it. We're not there to hassle the American people at the border. We're there to protect them. How do we galvanize them and get them thinking about that every day and knowing that they have, you know, thousands of people and shipments to deal with? And so that's a real focus of ours, is engaging a culture of leadership, reaching out to our frontline personnel, and ensuring that we understand how important they are and supporting them in what they do every day.
And I assume with any law enforcement agency, integrity is at its soul. To what end, what are you doing to sustain or implement a culture of integrity?
First, we need to ensure that the people we bring in on the very front end, the people that we hire, are of the highest character and moral fiber. They're fit for the public trust that we're placing in them. Secondly, we need to engage in prevention efforts by continuing to drive a culture of integrity. And third, we need to be able to detect and then swiftly address corruption in our ranks in conjunction with our investigative partners, our Office of Internal Affairs, Office of Inspector General, the ICE Office of Professional Responsibility, and of course, the Federal Bureau of Investigation and their Border Corruption Task Force, which has a critical role. So on that first point, we've made a lot of progress as an organization, as CBP. The Office of Internal Affairs has really worked aggressively to improve the background process. And now, 3 months ahead of the schedule set forth in the Anti-Corruption Act, we are administering polygraph examinations to over 100% of all CBP law enforcement applications. And that's a very new area for us, and we think is really going to help us on the front end in protecting the integrity of the folks that are joining us in the first place. On the prevention side, for field operations part, we've established integrity officers in each field office that go out to the front line and engage in training, engage in outreach with our managers and our first-line personnel. And I'm gratified that the last two significant arrests of frontline CBP officers were actually detected by the Office of Field Operations, by our folks looking at our systems and trying to make sure that we had the most integrity possible.
What does the future hold for the U.S. Customs and Border Protection? We will ask Kevin McAleenan, Acting Assistant Commissioner of Field Operations for CBP, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. What is NIH doing to advance basic and biomedical research? How can government better manage risk, reduce waste, and use resources more effectively? What are the benefits of e-diplomacy? How are agencies adopting innovative technologies in open government? And what are some of the key issues for governing in the next 4 years? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. This edition highlights the latest trends and best practices for improving government effectiveness by introducing you to government executives, public management practitioners, leading academics, and the differing ways they tackle many of the pressing public management issues facing us today. Hear from NIH Director Dr. Francis Collins, OMB's Danny Warfel, NCUA Chair Debbie Matz, VA's Dr. Peter Levin, and Rich Boley from the State Department.
All of this and much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order or download your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Kevin McAleenan, Acting Assistant Commissioner, Office of Field Operations with the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Andy Mayner.
Kevin, clearly we're in a new era for CBP, a new mission era, a new budget era. How do you take the agency forward and balance all of this?
This is, you know, an area where we're really focusing right now. And how do we transition from a period of significant resource support to an area where resource is much more constrained? And on the positive side, in terms of supporting our frontline personnel, we were able to successfully make the case and got a lot of support from the administration, from the Hill, to upgrade our frontline officers to.